questions, but let's allow the Momo to take us through the presentation. Are you the one taking or the board?
Madam Chair, before we go on, if I could interrupt you before we start, that's okay?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm a little bit concerned about tomorrow's meeting being a closed meeting. I'm not sure that that's possible in terms of the rules of Parliament, and I've asked for some clarity from you, and I'm not sure whether you've received my letter or not. How did that happen? And perhaps Frank can help us with the legal opinion of whether it is indeed possible in terms of the rules to close the meeting tomorrow.
Yes, Honourable, the Secretariat brought your matter to my attention and I investigated since I was not part of the last meeting that dealt with the SAA report, and I was advised that this meeting resolved that tomorrow's meeting is going to be a closed meeting on the basis that SAA will be tabling its turnaround strategy. So it's a decision of the committee. It was taken in the meeting, in your presence. I was not part of that meeting, but I was given that report. I also consulted the chair, confirmed that. Let me give Advocate Jenkins, if he wants to say anything about what... before that, Honourable...
Can I suggest that we deal with today's issue and afterwards the committee will remain and deal with tomorrow's agenda? As raised by Honourable Sakata.
That's a suggestion. It's seconded. Okay, we'll deal with that matter later. And okay, Jenkins, can you please make time to remain later or to engage on this issue that has been raised now? Okay. Let's get the presentation.
Okay, Chair, I think we need your guidance, but let me just say what we have planned. So the last time, and apologies, I wasn't here, I was in Washington for the spring meetings. But the last time, the Treasury made a presentation on our approach to the regulations. Of course, there was a minor issue, a major issue, of whether the regulations were formally submitted or not. They weren't obviously done through the ATC and so on. So we can deal with that at some point. There was a presentation from the Prudential Authority, which you saw. There was no time for the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, and we wanted them to start just so that members can see what's happening. And so what I want to propose is let's do that presentation, then we can come back to all other issues. If you want us to repeat the Treasury presentation, we could do so, but I don't think you want us to repeat it. But we can pick up on outstanding issues. I want to add, Chair and members, that just to make...
Before that,
yeah.
I saw that you sent us the consolidated public comment. That doesn't mean that you have to engage you. This is just for information.
No, it was given the last time as well. Did you go through it the last time? Yeah, we can go through it again. There's not much...
What is left, because remember the issue that was at hand was that the regulations were not formally tabled.
Yes.
So they are, we saw the document.
Yes.
The ATC, we did receive the copy of the ATC, and basically that's that. Our meeting is not going to be that long because we also need to attend to the budget issues that are taking place in the House. So I thought maybe there's any outstanding issue on the basis of things that might have been raised in the last meeting. But I don't remember any specific issue that was raised in the meeting that needs attention.
Yeah, so let's start with the first car and then we can go on. So, Chair, and just to be clear, and I know Roy did say it in his presentation, that the regs, in fact, have no impact at all on the establishment of the two authorities, okay? And so they have been established on the 1st of April. It does have, obviously, implications on how you choose the commissioners, the shortlisting processes, and so on. So let's maybe get Caroline, are you alone, and Rita? Okay, so do you want to just start? There's great excitement at, what do you call it now, FSCA, not FSCA. Okay. Okay, sorry, the other way now.
Sorry, thank you, Chair. We put a presentation together, but I'd like your guidance on how much time, because I can go into a lot of detail, a little bit of detail. So if you just give me some indication, if I'm going into too much detail, you'll just let me know. Okay, thank you, Chair. Okay, so this presentation this morning is just to really address, my name is Caroline De Silva, by the way. I'm an executive of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority and part of the Transition Committee, as set out in the regulations. And this is just a presentation to talk the members through the transition from the FSB to the FSCA. And I've, who's got the button? Sorry, Roy. So I've put a short presentation together. That's generally the agenda that I'm going to talk about. But what I thought I'd do first is I'd start on, if you can go to the next slide, the key differences between the FSCA and the FSB. All right, so just at a very high level, in terms of jurisdiction, the FSB was the regulator and supervisor of non-banking financial sector, everything except the banks. The banks were only included insofar as they rendered advice or intermediary services on non-banking products. So they sold insurance, and it also included deposit taking. In terms of the FSR Act, the FSCA is now responsible for all financial institutions, including banking. Previously, the Financial Services Board was a combined prudential and market regulator, but as we know, the Twin Peaks separated out those two activities, prudential regulation from market conduct, to manage conflicts of interest, as well as to have a double-eye view on systemic risks. So we are now a dedicated market conduct regulator, and that means essentially that all of our prudential activities and all the people that manage prudential activities moved to the Prudential Authority in October last year. Our grounding legislation or founding legislation used to be the FSB Act. It's now the Financial Sector Regulation Act. And the legislation that we used to oversee was a whole range of sector-specific laws. I think we've counted, we have 13 sector-specific laws that we managed inside the FSB. We had the Long-Term Act, the Short-Term Insurance Act, the FASE Act, the FSCA, the Pension Funds Act, the Financial Markets Act, etc., etc. The future of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority is that all of these existing sector-specific laws will be replaced by one cross-cutting, overarching Conduct of Financial Institutions Act, which goes to the conduct of all financial institutions. And that has significant implications for us from an organizational perspective, which I'll go into. As the FSR Act goes live, there's been a lot of expectation in the sector that everything will be big bang, according to the Conduct Authority. The reality is that certain sections of the FSR come in at different times. So as we went live on the 1st of April, for example, banks are still licensed by the Prudential Authority. There is no banking law around conduct. That conduct will be regulated in the Conduct of Financial Institutions Act. But the FSR Act does allow us to pass standards in between now and the Conduct of Financial Institutions Act if there's any activity we feel needs to be regulated from a market conduct perspective. So we have the power to make standards. We used to have a board, an independent board, with an executive structure, and that's been replaced, as you saw in the transitional regs, with the commissioner structure. And at the moment, we have a transitional management committee, which plays the role of the commissioner, or there is a commissioner that plays a role there, until the full-time commissioners are appointed. And, of course, that also affects the regulatory decision-makers, because the commissioner then becomes accountable for the day-to-day activities. And the EXCO in the transition period, as the regs set out. So, Roy, if you want to go to the next one? Okay. So when I said to you that all the sector-specific laws will be replaced by one overarching Conduct of Financial Institutions Act, this also impacts how we organize ourselves, because at the moment we're very siloed. So you have one institution, for example, that might be subject to six or seven different pieces of legislation, sometimes with different definitions of the same things. This creates a burden of compliance and a burden of cost. It also allows for arbitrage because people can fall in between the different sectoral laws. So the future organizational design will be aligned with one single Conduct of Financial Institutions Act. That means at the moment, as we designed an affairs department or an insurance department or a pensions department, in future will be structured on a functional basis. So we have one licensing department for all financial institutions, one supervision department for all financial institutions, one enforcement department across all financial institutions, but also with particular sector skills inside those departments and a focus on group supervision. And this has been part of our journey so far. So,
Caroline, just to give an example, I mean, let's look at the recent case of VBS.
Yes.
Vele, okay? VBS was regulated by only the SARP, banking registrar, and the Vele would have been under various parts of the FSB.
Okay. So, yeah.
Now, once this model is fully operational, they'll both be regulated by both authorities, and information can be shared much better than, I guess, when it's two different organizations.
So I think it's even more than that, Mama and members. So if you had BBS, the bank, was regulated by the Prudential Authority, and the Financial Services Board, as it were, had very little insight into the bank.
But this debate doesn't belong here.
No, it's just to give you an idea.
I think it was just to show you that there's a more comprehensive and approach that can be.
But I also want to demonstrate that even the silos within the FSB, you'd have different supervisors on different aspects of the group. Now we'll have one holistic view of the group. So we've been talking about readiness of the FSCA for some time. So I wanted to put this slide up just to show you that we've been working on the transition since 2012. So it's been a six-year journey for us with a huge level of detail right down to, you know, process analysis down to detail level 3, but we've done it through various steering committees and executive committees, but also with various consultants to give us insight as to what happened internationally, lessons to be learned, and so forth. I'm not going to talk about the implementation structures that were on the previous slide, but if I can go to the next slide. One of the FSRA requirements is that within 6 months of the FSCA going live, we have to publish our strategy. And the strategy has to be published for adoption by the commissioners and consulted with the industry. Now, we are very, very close to finalizing the strategy. So if you look at the third block of bullets, these are the things I want to focus on. So for the next 3 years, we will be required to some extent to be a little internally focused as we go through this organizational redesign and place our people into these functional structures. So that's one part of the strategy. The second part of the strategy, of course, is a robust regulatory framework, and that goes to both assisting with the COFI legislation, but it also goes to making sure that the Conduct of Financial Institutions Act also aligns nicely with the Financial Markets Act in terms of the integrity of the capital markets, and looks at entities and services that were previously not supervised by us. And that goes to some extent to credit and the conduct around credit, and all of these things have to be wrapped up not only in a robust regulatory framework, but also in a memorandum of understanding between the different regulators to make sure that we close the gaps and are comprehensive. A third strategic focus, of course, the continuation of a customer of fair treatment of customers, and the Conduct of Financial Institutions Act is really structured on the six treating customer fairly principles along with really good governance. So it now puts into statute a program that we've been rolling out for the last 5 years. We also, in terms of the new approach, we have to move away from being a compliance, tick-the-box, reactive organization to one that's more proactive, preemptive, and intrusive. And a good example of how you get intrusive is to change structures in the industry that we think are resulting in poor outcomes. We have a program called a Retail Distribution Review, which goes to fair standards for advice and distribution. And it looks at the incentives in the market, how we incentivize advisors, and how they're potentially conflicted by product providers. Part of the new objective of the FSR Act is an objective for the conduct authority very specifically on inclusion. So we have inclusion as a financial strategic objective to build an inclusion and transformation. And finally, of course, fintech, because that's developing very quickly in the market. So we have a fintech strategy as well. And our objectives and requirements on consumer education have also been highlighted in the FSR Act. So we'll be moving away from an organization that did consumer education projects to one that tries to get the best bang for the buck, as it were, out of the entire sector to make sure that they're spending their money on sustainable projects that really make a difference to the national strategy. So those are the main themes of our strategy going forward, that, as I said, will be published when it's completed. The transitional products we've looked at, and I'll go through this very briefly, of course, is the regulatory strategy, which I've just spoken about. The funding model, I've included a slide in the presentation, which we'll get to later, which is not 100% accurate, so I want to just put that on the table because things shift as they move along. But we've read in press with things like the Free Market Foundation that the Twin Peaks model will cost us 6.5 billion rand. We don't know where we get those numbers. Our numbers over the next 3 years as we map out, as we fill vacancies, come to just less than 150 million. Which, if we align with international Twin Peaks market conduct regulators, it's about the same in terms of almost a third of the budget increase to take on this new jurisdiction and new activity. So way, way less than 6.5 billion. We've done all our process mapping to ensure this functional approach, and we have started the staff placements already. It happened as soon as the commissioner was appointed, and we could start nominating the staff. And, of course, we have new office space planning, new logos, new designs, which you've seen. So all of that have been done and went live day one with all the domains, email addresses, branding, logos, etc. The other transitional projects, of course, that we have to put in place new governance structures in terms of the FSR. We have been procuring a new integrated regulatory system. So at the moment, I said 13 pieces of law, 13 different systems. We need to integrate those so we have a single view of any financial institution or any group, and we've done an entire data cleanup and data integrity to map all the information, so when I put in any company, I can get all information across all the sectoral laws, and we've done the rebranding. Thanks, Roy. Okay, I've spoken about those. Those are some of the big things we did for Go Live day one, and all of those are completed. Okay. Some of the cross-cutting market projects that have been important, that have been going on for a few years and will continue, is, of course, the FMA and the wholesale conduct workstream, how we deal with retail customers versus wholesale. The Ombud diagnostic, which also informed the FSR Act and the approach to Ombud systems and alternative dispute resolution. We have the governance standards committee, which looks at all of the international standards, adjust them for selecting principles, test all our sectoral law against those governance standards to make sure we have best practice, and that work is almost completed. We've just worked with the National Treasury, who appointed the World Bank to do a retail banking diagnostic on retail behaviors of banking, which will help us inform the standards until the COFI legislation comes through. We've spoken about RDR. So these are just some of the projects that we did that we feel will help customers in terms of good customer outcomes. I've put this slide on just because there's a lot of questions around licensing into the future. So essentially, between now and the Conduct of Financial Institutions Act, organizations will continue to be licensed under the current sectoral laws, phase, insurance, whatever it may be. Sorry, I'm going to correct that. So they'll continue to be licensed under current sectoral laws. Insurance obviously moved to the Prudential Authority, and that's where the licensing responsibility sits, and they will do conversion of current registrations to licensing. I just wanted to give you some sense of the numbers of institutions that we regulate across the different sectoral laws, so you can get an understanding how much data integrity work there was to try and collate all this information about these institutions. But it's also important that if you look at 11,260 FSPs, 1,400 of these might be sole props, where a lot of them could be huge financial institutions. So the legislation that we go into has to make sure that it's proportionate, so it doesn't create too much barrier to entry to new entrants, and it doesn't make them unsustainable. So it's very important that our new mandate in terms of being proportionate is taken very, very seriously, and that's not just from a regulation perspective, but also a supervision perspective. In order to be completely feasible in terms of delivering our mandate, we have to do things a little bit differently in future. We cannot, it's not possible to see every single institution every single month or every single year, even once a year, because there's so many institutions. So we have to get very clever on data. So what we've done is we've started shifting our data requirements so that institutions report to us on their market conduct returns, that's analyzing their business, their compliance reports, their financial statements. All of this data is analyzed through a proposed data analytics program where we can identify flags that will drive theme-based visits or on-site visits for mis-selling. And we will also build in a specialist department that will look at advertising and marketing scanning to see what's happening in the market in terms of consumer trends. And we also have reporting on complaints from everyone, not just what complaints they've had, but how they dealt with them and how they resolved them. And these will all drive theme-based visits where necessary, where there are any flags for mis-selling. We also started our fintech capability in our regulatory strategy, which looks at regulatory technology and supervisory technology to look at building an artificial intelligence over this data analytics to keep on picking out more viable flags to drive good on-site visits, because the future is not about reacting to harm. It's about, as far as possible, identifying it before it occurs and being intrusive and changing the practices to prevent poor customer outcomes. It's a tough ask, but we have to be very, very clever with data and with analytics. Okay, so basically before COFI comes into place, all the current sectoral laws and licensing won't be affected. The banks will be licensed by the FSCA, but we may set conduct standards, as I've said. Insurance licensing moves to the FSCA, but it is done with concurrence with the FSCA. Credit providers are currently licensed by the National Credit Regulator, who look after the contract of credit, but we will have responsibility to set conduct standards around the provision of that credit. And we're sitting down with the NCR at the moment because we have to draft this MOU within 6 months, just to make sure we don't overlap and there's no arbitrage between the two of us. Okay, sorry, next slide. The licensing in future as well is, instead of having multiple licenses, which they currently have, they might have 5 licenses under phase, a license under insurance, a license under investments, a license under whatever. The future of COFI is per institution or per group, per institution, one license with multiple activities. So I'm hereby authorized to issue banking products, insurance products, give advice, intermediary services, administration, investment management. So it's much more effective and efficient, one license, multiple activities, but also for what kind of customers, retail customers or wholesale customers, because the proportionality of the law is very important. Okay. It will also, as I said, allow for consolidation of fragmented licenses. Some big groups have up to 20 licenses and now allows them to consolidate, which is much more cost effective in terms of supervision. We don't want to start from scratch doing relicensing of everybody. The data cleanup and data management that we've done will allow us to collect as much information as we have to allow for a very easy conversion to the new activity license, which we will pre-populate. I think the reality is that for some institutions who've only ever been subject to one regulator, in future there will be two regulators, a conduct regulator and a prudential regulator. The dual licensing system is key to Twin Peaks, and I think it's important to understand that it's equal Twin Peaks, equal licenses. You cannot operate unless you have both licenses, both equally important. I've just put up the organogram to show the functional design. It's a little bit outdated, so I just want to give that caveat as well on this slide, because you'll see under regulatory policy, that's just licensing, but there have been some shift to cater for new developments and new things we've learned. I put the budget slide up just to give you an idea of the numbers to show that they're nowhere near what they were in the press. And the next slide, Roy, is there are some governance structures that are required by the FSR Act. I've highlighted what those are, and those governance committees will form or perform a dual role, not just for the FSCA, but also for the statutory ombud. The organizational design, in terms of the headcount changes that we've identified that we need to manage all of these additional functions as well as the specialist functions, we've calculated at the moment around 107 people. I can't see the numbers up there. It's around 108 people, but those won't all be big bang. It'll be over a three-year period, and we've factored in the vacancy periods to fill all those positions over the next 3 years. And that's the functional design of the organogram, and the executive heads and heads of department are currently in the process of being appointed now that we have a commissioner in terms of transitional legs. So I've spoken about the organizational design being a functional one, so I don't think I need to go into it anymore, except that we have in the design built in some specializations that we never had before, behavioral economists, advertising and scanning and marketing, as I've said, and data analytics and fintech, as well as inclusion departments, not only to focus on the licensing for transformation purposes, but also a department that specializes or focuses on ensuring the legislation is continuously proportionate without creating barriers to entry, but also to support those that are already licensed from not losing their licenses because of non-compliance. So it's more of a support division. So there in a nutshell, at a very high level, is our transition to date. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I hope the sector will take kindly to it in many ways. You know, they always have different opinions about transition. I hope it's well received. Members, that's time to get to questions. Is there any indication for a question? Honourable Peggy?
Thanks. Great. I have only one question to ask. Is there a reason why there will be no board that will be overseeing the functioning of the executive committee? Or to put it differently, to whom will this EXCO be accountable?
Any further questions? Okay, I only have one question. It relates to the market conduct readings reports. How are you going to generate them? Is the sector going to generate them and you check for their integrity, or are you going to have officials from your side who will be on site doing that type of work to check compliance?
The issue of how best to have good governance over regulatory agency was something that we've been looking at for a number of years. The model that we've chosen is that on the one hand, you see, if you looked at the FSB, it basically had a board, and I'll come back to some of the challenges with when you have a board over the regulatory agency, and it had an EXCO, so it had the deputy executive the executive officer, who's Dube Shiri, and under him you had deputy DEOs, deputy executive officers. So you had one for pensions or retirement funds, one for capital markets, etc. And the way the system has worked is each of those DEOs would effectively look at subsectors. When we looked at the conduct authority, we said this thing of creating sectors, firstly, is not very effective, because what you'll find is financial institutions are often, they don't just do retirement funds, they also do insurance. Okay, So we want to actually focus on the activities. That's why if we look at the licensing arrangement, we've changed the approach as well. Now, how does that all relate to governance? The board that you have under the FSB then would basically just look at, wouldn't really and couldn't get involved in any of the regulatory issues. So now you look at the new model, what's different is rather than each sort of section or silo within the FSB deciding on specific license, one decided on pensions, one decided on insurance, one decided on investment companies, etc. Now you've got a group of commissioners, the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. They will make the decisions as a collective, so that no one person makes a decision. No one is a czar. Now it's a collective decision over financial institutions. You may still have departments, but when it gets to the key processes, be it licensing, be it any other approvals, it gets to the commissioners as a collective. Now, you have then a similar issue with the SARB, that the governor makes the decisions for the Reserve Bank. So the question then is, what oversight do you have? So rather than have a board, where we find that often the sorts of problems then you had was you had to make sure no player was active in the financial sector, because then there would be both player and referee, possibly. Secondly, the board then just focused on governance, remuneration, and so on. So what we've done is, rather than, because the whole approach of having a King IV type board doesn't make sense for a regulatory agency, that's what we found. So what we have now is a governance committee and a remuneration committee. What other committees do we have? So just give the committees.
The committee for remuneration, HR and REM, I know it does. The audit committee and the procurement committees.
So, yeah, but the procurement committee will still be internal. But if you look at external, the governance committee, what you call it again, governance, that's appointed by the DG of the Treasury, so it's an external committee. Similarly, the remuneration committee and the audit committees are appointed externally, so that they do the oversight over the entity. So that was the model that we chose. There are different models, like if you look at the Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S., that also has commissioners rather than, say, a board. So it was a toss-up between commissioners and board. I should point out, if you look at the SARB, too, you find that the governor is both the head of the executive as well as the head of the board, even though there are, as you know, lots of non-executives on the board itself. So we have the notion of non-executives in those oversight committees that have been set up. There was a long discussion on this as we went through the bill. I'm just trying to give you a summary of the issues that we looked at.
Thank you, Chair. And then to your question around the market conduct returns. So historically, because we were compliance-driven, I suppose reactive in terms of ticking the box, have you complied with these certain rules, we used to have what we call compliance reports, where the institution have a compliance officer who give a confirmation that they've complied with all the laws. If we really need to be proactive and preemptive in terms of preventing customer harm, we really have to understand the business models of organizations. So the market conduct returns go far wider than compliance, but they're submitted by individual institutions on their own business model. What does my business model look like? How do I design products? How do I target my segment? Am I selling to that segment? How many customers do I have? What is my growth? What are my losses? All of that business information from each financial institution presented to the FSCA. So they're not public documents as such that will be published, but obviously in our annual returns or annual reports we will publish the outcomes of any. But the market conduct returns are really business model analysis information about the insides of the business.
Can I make a follow-up? You know, the reason why I'm asking this question is because many companies have business models
that they've always had. But in relation to market conduct, they've always behaved contrary to the principles that they set down in terms of how they treat consumers. And to me, that's the gist of the matter, even in the current conjuncture in the market. So this strategy is going to be very important going forward to ensure that you don't find many cases that leads to disputes on the basis of how people conduct themselves, even when they presented good models and strategies. So that's why I was interested in how, apart from just those reports, the proactiveness that the system is going to be to do, not apart from checkups, but, you know, find a way of, at any given point, to look at how the markets conduct themselves. And, you know, I can tell you best of an anecdote of my recent experience with a company that we hired. The guy did not tell us that if we drop it in another city, they're going to charge us. So I want to launch a dispute because they did not say it. And they're insisting that they told us, and they did not tell us. So that's basically what people and companies do. And they will want to say to you, look at the regulations, look at the piece of document in front of you, when in actual fact you're supposed to explain to the consumer to understand what's written in fine print. And it's not resolved. It's still part of strategies that the market imposes to consumers in a very unfair manner. So how we zoom in into that specific thing becomes important.
I agree with you 100%. And if you just think about the sort of culture shift and the activity shift that we have to have, basically the old practice would be that you would come and complain to the FSB that they didn't disclose, and then we would go and react and say you didn't disclose. Now the situation is with that business model analysis, and if you look at some of the cross-cutting projects, one of them was called KIDS, which is a key information disclosure document. So the whole of the COFI legislation is built on the principles of treating customers fairly. It's about your governance first. How does your board interact with your executive? How does your executive interact with the staff? How do you incentivize them? How do you challenge each other? Can you whistleblow? All of that governance stuff. And then it starts with the design of the product. So it's how do you design your products? How do you make sure they're fair? And what is the governance process? How do you make sure it's being designed for a specific need to a specific customer? How do you then distribute it and set it to make sure it gets to the right customer? How do you disclose all of these things that are important that should be disclosed? How do you make it simple language that they understand? How do you allow them to complain and resolve debates? And so it goes right through the process of the entire product from a proactive basis. And you'll have institutions that will all have a lead supervisor who deals with them on a daily basis. This is my lead supervisor with a team who goes in and sits in on the board meetings, understands their processes, looks at their products, versus the thousands of small institutions who we will drive it through data and conduct returns. So we're hoping it will deliver a much more proactive approach to building treating customers fairly into the culture of the business rather than us just reacting to complaints.
If I may come in, because I think your question is very important. The point is that the conduct authority is meant to be much more than what the FSB was before, okay? Because as you know, before it was a banking and a non-banking regulator. Initially when they were set up, they did not do market conduct or consumer protection effectively. But over time, the FSB took those on, it took on initiatives like the treat customers fairly and so on. So they became more and more, they began to do some market conduct. Now, as we move to this form, and I always say, you know, I would like to make three points which I think is important to note, that the FSCA today is not the FSCA that we want it to be, hopefully in a year's time, when it starts exercising its more intrusive powers. It has a staff, etc. Obviously, at the moment, the FSCA is, in a sense, still the FSP in a new form. But so there's a bit of continuity, but it does need to work differently from the FSP. Hence, I think the issue is the leadership will be new once you have the commissioners, the deputy commissioners, and so on. Secondly, I think we are still in a period of transition, and in a sense, the transition is the most risky period, because on the one hand, you're no longer the FSP, yet you come from the FSP. On the other hand, people also have expectations that you'd be exercising your full powers when they're actually not going to be exercising their full powers initially. It's going to have to be phased in some sections and some laws like the coffee bill, etc. That process still has to be completed. But more importantly, it's getting the personnel at the top. And that's why I think the transition mechanisms are quite important, because it's to move from the old to the new, which we want to do hopefully as soon as possible, because the sooner the FSP has a new leadership. And I want to emphasize, it is going to be a new leadership. We haven't done all this. We haven't done this reform to kind of have the FSB in another name, okay? We want to build on the FSB, but it is going to be a new institution. So I guess those are the two key points just around when we look at the structure and where it's going to. And now that they are the FISCA, now is the time for them to start looking more concretely at the regulatory strategies that they're going to develop so that they can exercise their role as a market conduct authority. Hence, they have 6 months, and the clock is ticking, to actually develop that strategy. And in the same time, they need to be determining the structure. And I think what Caroline was saying, for example, many conduct authorities have, you know, a behavioral unit, okay, which is to try and ensure that products in a financial market that come through, like you say, the fine print, people don't tell you. You know, you should be signing those things if they want to tell you, so that these things are explicit for them to apply. Or you might find that you're an ombud, okay? Now, although we haven't changed the ombud system yet, you'll find that certain functions don't fall under this ombud, they fall under another ombud. I mean, the system is just needlessly complex to confuse the consumer. We want to simplify that. So I think the focus is, let's treat customers fairly and let's make this a more customer-focused system that we actually want to put in place. And I would contend that it does need a culture change in all the regulators to begin to move in that direction. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any further questions, members? Okay, that brings us to the end of the presentation. Thank you. Thank you for the hard work on this one, Roy and the team. Okay, members, then it takes us to... Yeah, you are released as we now go into. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Play golf. I might go to the gym, but sorry, we have left quite a few documents, legal opinions, etc., for you to look at, but if I may just say this, I think the approach is, whatever the kind of missteps or so in the formal tabling, I think the spirit we have is to consult with the committee, and so even in these new regulations, if there are comments, you know, we can still take them on board. So I think the spirit is in that form. We would like to leave it at that. Thanks.
No, no. We understood that it was just a technical mistake as to how it was done. It was not really changing the content of what was the. We had unfortunate comments in our absentia. We thought maybe Freud should have been here to raise them when you're here, because I always believe it becomes unfair if you raise issues about somebody in their absentia when they can't respond to you. So there is basically no issues that related to content that was raised in the previous meeting. So I think we're all happy. Yes, then, honourable members, it takes us to our second agenda item, which is the report on the Standing Committee on Finance on Budget Board 7, National Treasury, which is dated to the 15th of May, 2018. The Standing Committee on Finance, SCOF, having considered the National Treasury 2018-2019 budget and annual performance plan, has reported. The report has been sent to you, all members, so I put it to you for the adoption. Any honourable lady?
Thank you, honourable chair. I move for the adoption of the report.
There's a mover for the adoption, honourable Liz.
Madam Chair, there's a number of things in the report we need to deal with before we can adopt it, or we could adopt it as is, as flawed as it is, but all right, so I don't know if you want us to look at each,
Is it content or is it a typo?
It's both.
Let's deal with it.
Okay. Page 2.3, That paragraph, that section, the Minister said that the National Treasury funding and supporting the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture by providing information. I'm not sure what is meant by those three words, by providing information. The Minister said that National Treasury funding and supporting, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. But it might be my lack of understanding. And then on the very next line, National Treasury is determined to rebuilding and branding, to rebuild and rebrand. That's semantic. If it, on 2.3. So I'm not sure how to amend the middle sentence. I would suggest we just drop the words by providing information. The Minister said that National Treasury is funding and supporting the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. Stop.
No, but you're right. The Minister did indicate that they are funding. And I thought he said they are also providing information about how they are doing that. I think that's... they missed one point about what he meant about provision of information.
I'm entirely happy to move the providing information into move those two words to it is National Treasury is funding, providing information and supporting the Commission. Then it makes sense. I'm not arguing about with you.
I'm agreeing with you. And even that of the rebranding and rebuilding can be changed. Can we get the changed report before? Because I don't want it to affect the voting on the report, because we're doing it now.
You want the wording?
No, I'm saying they should provide the latest version. Maybe an hour after we've adopted the report. You may continue, remember?
Madam Chair, then it's semantic, I know, but there's a use of terminology. The normal terminology would be to refer to the committee decided or the committee recommended, but it then switches between that kind of terminology to we and our. Too personal. And there's a mixture of personifying it as opposed to corporatizing it. It's semantic, it doesn't make a difference to the content really, but it just jars when you read it. So that flows throughout the whole report.
I take the point where it says he further explained, it should say the minister further explained. Or the department. Mr. Mukhajani, but the department. Yeah. Correct all those that goes paragraph by paragraph, speaking to what Honorable Lins is raising to us. May continue, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then 5.1, the second line, the committee.
I wanted to come in before.
Sorry.
My apologies. On the second, the last sentence of 2.3, yeah, I don't know, I'm not sure how we finalize that one. No, the second from bottom, rebuild and branding of SARS. How have we finalized it?
Well, we can say the minister said that the National Treasury is determined to rebuild the SARS brand or rebrand the SARS. I'm not a linguist. Thank you. Yeah, rebuild the SARS brand. Is that okay? Tepuhua Mudis Tepa, she's interested. To rebuild the SARS brand, is it acceptable to all members? Okay. That's okay. Yeah, well, enjoy Mazulu, because you have to pay attention. I'm not going to stay in Zulu, because the pattern of Mazulu. Mazulu wodwa phela apha comrade nathi nini nodwa apha. No, it's one of our jokes in the committee, you get used to it. We call it. Lovely, continue.
Madam Chair, now this is one of some substance. If we go to 5.3, now, it's kind of like two-thirds of the way down. However, we do not support wholesale privatization of SOCs. Page 7, 5.3. Okay, so if that's the feeling of the majority on the committee, that's fine, but then I would suggest that it says, however, the majority in the committee, as has been used in other sections, it's put that way. I'm happy for that, although I'm not sure that we did actually make such a decision as, I don't remember the committee actually discussing that. But anyway, that's as long as it doesn't throw me and my party in with that view, that's all.
Sure.
It might well be a privatization.
Okay, let me take all members who want to speak first. Honorable Nati, Honorable Gwen, Honorable Dikeledi, in that order, please.
No, Madam Chair, just two things on that one. The easier one, let me just that very same line. There's something wrong with it. Let me see. Where am I now? It says, however, we do not support wholesale privatization of SAOs is that serve. You know, so basically, we are anti country developmental kind of goals. That's what it conveys. So it has got to be reconstructed. Okay. Or yes. It says, however, we do not support wholesale privatization of resources that serve the country's developmental goals. Now, basically, the essence is that we're anti-development. That's what it says. So the best option, really, is to either make one point separate from the other. We do not support wholesale privatization of SOEs, full stop. You know, and that's basically, if we want to make a point about the country's developmental goals, then we can do a different sort of construction there, and so on. But let me then come to the issue that is raised by Honorable Lee here. I'm not sure what the standard practice has been in the committee, but it would be incorrect that if you have a majority decision taken, you don't want to reflect it that way. You want to also then say, yeah, but there were also others that disagreed and they said this. Now, I think that's not democratic in the first instance. However, if the committee is of the view that there also has got to be a minority reflection of the report, then you must then have a different sort of construction of such a report, which would mean that you have this report, but you have also another report that captures points of disagreements by, let's say, for instance, a minority view within the committee, and so it goes. There is also a third option. The third option is that in the construction of a report such as this, yes, we could put this point across of we're not for the wholesale privatization of SOEs, but also note, and just make a note in the report, that there is also a view that differs from this particular position, and so on, not necessarily ascribing that view to any particular sort of political formation or any individual in the committee, for example. So it's between those two things. So I don't, let, from a process point of view, those are my comments around that. But I think the first point is that there has got to be a reconstruction of that particular line. Thank you very much.
I give let me explain, Honorable Nhleko. We have not compiled minority reports. We have one committee report, and what we have done in the past in all our reports where there are parties that don't agree or support, we will note their objections. But when the majority view is, it carries as a committee view. It has been like that. And this issue did arise of us not necessarily supporting a wholesale approach towards privatization. It's a consistent issue, a view that has been expressed in all our engagements when it relates to SOEs. So it's not a new subject altogether. It just needs to be rephrased in relation to how it's put there, especially where it says to serve the country's developmental goals. That's where they need to be changed. But let's give Honorable Gwen and Honorable Masang to raise their views.
I just wanted clarification on that point about national, basically that the National Treasury is considering a private sector participation framework. I'm a bit confused as to whether the the department is of the same mind as the minister. I mean, I don't want to put, I mean, I stand to be corrected, but I'm almost certain there was a meeting at which we were informed that that was not on the table, that, you know, plans was to look at to, you know, bring SAA to be, or and SOEs to being profitable, that there wasn't an actual plan to, or model being looked at to privatize or even partly privatize any of them. I mean, I don't remember such documents, unless they use the word considered in a very loose way that, you know, we've thought about it. But I don't remember any actual considered, there's no documents or various models that have been presented showing different, you know, private sector participation and what that might look like. So it's not a serious consideration. They might say it's been thought about, but I don't recall anything ever being put on the table. And in fact, as I say, I stand to be corrected, but I almost feel like I remember someone, either it was someone from the department, so I'm saying that that's actually not on the table.
Well, the disadvantage, Honorable Gwen, is that you came a little bit later in the picture. You will not know that maybe there's a commission that has actually been given the responsibility to specifically look at the feasibility of keeping the state-owned enterprises as they are and so on. So there is serious consideration of different models as we speak. It's on the table.
Has that commission reported to the...
No, the commission has not yet reported. We are waiting for it to finish its work.
Oh, okay. So that's the state that it's at.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, are you okay?
It includes SA in that commission.
All state ones. Okay. Honorable Masangu, Honorable David, and Honorable Nati. And remember, I can't keep you for long. I'll be in trouble with the wee party. You need to go to the house and listen to the debate. So let's not re-engage on issues of policy that you have long surpassed and where we agree to disagree as parties. Because that's basically what we are doing now. We are re-emphasizing on party views, all things that we have long surpassed and agreed. So because there is new members, naturally we will take it through and so on, and some will take advantage because there's new hoping that you will come with different views. People know, all these ones were steadfast. So it happens all the time on our members. Members try their luck and all that and so on. But in the interest of time, I request us not to try it this time because we know it won't work. Let's just do the just and honorable thing and look at whether there's gaps about what is left out from the discussions we had. And the typology is normal because the authors of the documents are also Zulus. The authors of the documents are Zulus, so they don't... They were not born and bred in England and so on. So let's leave it, honorable. Let's not push it. Let's look at what is left out really and make it easy. Honorable, like whether you're good, you know the line. The line is like that. It has not changed. So honorable is just doing his part work, trying to change the policy of the ANC and so on. And that's what I'm saying we know, you see. No, there's only one ANC. You see, when I was the last person to speak, because here's your confusion right here at the door. Your confusion is right here at this door, here around the corner. When how did you get met here? There's confusion. You need to still deal with it. So leave us. Honorable members, is there anything that you want to correct in the document or any substantive matters that has been left out? The policy has not changed.
Honorable Chair, to a larger extent, you and Honorable Nhleko, you have covered me, and nothing has changed, Honorable Liz. In a democracy, if majority has agreed, there's a majority view, that's the view of the structure or the view of the meeting, irrespective of who feels how. And that point that you have brought, that we usually do, that there's
they always have reservations as we adopt the report. Like, we bring it at the end, we can't bring it to the court. So you are fine, I'm good. And we should also not be apologetic that we are anti-privatization. Agree with you. The other part is contradicting.
Make sure that all the corrections are made on time in the document. As you are listening to the discussions in the House, you can mull over those corrections. Please highlight them when you send it. Members, if you don't say anything, I'm going to take it that with the corrections that has been made, I'll have to put the report. Honorable Liz?
Obviously, we're going to reserve our rights on the report as normal. But just on 519, yeah, they're at the end there. Again, I think it's probably just a position difference. We certainly don't agree with that last sentence that there's not sufficient attention paid in the National Treasury's briefing. The budget as a whole, we believe, really does target radical socio-economic transformation, if you want to call it that. It certainly targets economic growth, and not in the way we would probably do it. We would be probably more robust about it. But I think that that last sentence, or those last two lines, we probably don't agree with, but again, if that's your view, then that's fine, so be it.
I remember that Honorable Nkoyeni was very passionate about this point, that this budget should reflect the transformation agenda, and we never differed, including yourself, we never differed with her in the meeting. So if it's a new
Madam Chair, it's not new. A lot of things are said by members in meetings that we disagree with. We don't have a rebuttal at every instance.
No, Honourable Member. All I'm saying, in principle, I'm saying in the meeting when she raised this issue, you didn't engage her to say, but we don't agree. But it's fine if you changed your view later on, or. No, it's fine if you find a view at a later stage. It's okay. But the point was made, and we agreed with it in principle. We came from a view where we believe that National Treasury should do more in relation to transformation, and much should have been attended to. She was very passionate about it, and we agreed. We did not have any other view in the meeting that will suggest that this view must not hold. So it's okay if later on you found a view. Honorable members, I need to thank you for your attention. I therefore put the report to you. It was already having a mover. Now I need a seconder to the Honorable Koyin seconds. You reserve your right. So it will be noted that the DA reserves its rights to vote on this. Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for your attention and for the work that you have done. Tomorrow it will be my last day as the Chair. So we have an issue that you wanted to raise about SAA, so this is our chance to raise it. Advocate Jenkins, please address us.
Madam Chair, before Advocate Jenkins goes ahead, I'm not sure that he's been briefed, but I assume he has. But earlier on, the assertion was made that this was a decision of the meeting you weren't at, you said. And so I've now got the PMG record of that meeting, and the chairperson made a remark, and I'll read it to you. The committee would explore the possibility of having a closed meeting to engage on the market-sensitive information. So that's how PMG have recorded it. My memory, I know, is very bad, but I certainly do not recall any resolution of the committee, and PMG appear to support my memory.
Debohoy, you were the scribe of the day. Can you please clarify?
The chairperson, subsequently to that, then gave an instruction that I make an application for a closed meeting, so that in the next meeting that we have with SAA, we discuss the market-sensitive matters.
I'm not referring to the instruction, I'm referring to the decision of the meeting.
When the chairperson gave me the instruction, nobody opposed it, so I took it, yes, in the meeting. So
he instructed you in the meeting?
Yes.
Oh, so it was in the meeting?
Yes, it was in the meeting.
Honourable members, please help me, who was not here on that day, to understand what took shape. Honourable Nandi.
No, I think that the issue is clarified. If there was an expression of a view to consider a particular option in dealing with this particular matter, but then subsequent to that, it's then declared openly in the meeting. So it's a matter of public record that position was taken. Unless somebody stood up in the meeting and said, no, Chen, we disagree with you facilitating an application for a closed session. If there was no such, then indeed there was a decision taken. Of course, I wasn't there, I was not even a member of this committee by then. But taking into account what has just been explained, that indeed if that is so, it's correct then to then say the committee took a decision.
Yes, to amplify that point, Honorable Nhleko, we have agreed in principle as this committee that when it comes to a point where we need to discuss market-sensitive issues, we're going to close the meeting. In principle, we've agreed already. I can even make an example where we're in the the one that is standing for V227, when we were discussing the Makwakwa matter, that's when we agreed in principle that where there is matters that are sensitive, we must close meeting. When we were going to discuss that report, we were going to close the meeting. So what happened is that Mr. Makwakwa resigned before we could get to that point. So the committee agreed in that meeting in V227. So the chair was implementing what we've already agreed on issues of SAA when we were in Good Hope. Because in Good Hope, that's when we said we want a turnaround strategy, but we are going to close the meeting as it's presented. So the decision for SAA in particular was taken in Good Hope. Just to refresh, sometimes members are not there when these decisions are taken, and sometimes their memories are. So just to refresh your mind, that's the way it was taken, that because of the sensitive nature of the turnaround strategies, I remember I even said in the meeting, we need to be careful about how we present the strategies in front of our rivals, because maybe that's why we're not profitable. So I don't think, Honourable Members, we should see this issue unless there are other matters, but you cannot be discussing that in an open meeting based on the discussions we had. But let's give Honourable Members to satisfy themselves, and then we'll give Advocate Jenkins later to respond. David, you had your hand up. We'll follow, and then Honourable Liz.
Madam Chair, first of all, a discussion between a member of staff and the chair of the committee, which I wasn't privy to, or the committee wasn't privy to, certainly is not, whether it took place during the meeting or not the meeting, is not a resolution of the meeting. And the PMG record would reflect such a discussion if it was held in public. and it does not reflect it. And the PMG record is quite clear that it was the committee would explore the possibility of having a closed meeting. The committee has not explored that possibility. And so please could we have a copy of the application that the member of staff has made, to whom that application may have been made, and the response thereto. So if we could get that, that would be helpful. And then before Frank comes in, the question that needs to be answered from a legal point of view is whether the rules would allow for the meeting to discuss the SAA quarterly report to be a closed meeting. Because the rules make provision for three instances where a closed meeting is may be permitted. And so you refer to the Makwakwa matter, Madam Chair, and I would think that the Makwakwa matter is very different from the SAA one. The Makwakwa matter may conceivably fall under 1841B1 if the committee is considering a matter which is of a private nature that is prejudicial to a particular person. And so I don't know whether it would fall into that, but I would suggest that the Makwakwa matter might have qualified for a closed session in terms of that particular rule. I see no provision in the rules for a matter such as the SAA quarterly report to be held in a closed session. And so that's really what I think that Frank may be able to help us with, as opposed to going back to meetings in V227 or Good Hope Chamber, where I put it to you, Madam Chair, that at no stage during those meetings did the committee consider a definite proposal to close a meeting for SAA to present sensitive matters. The discussion has taken place in the past, but the committee has not made that decision. And the record of PMG of the last meeting confirms that that was our position. The committee would explore the possibility. And that was the last meeting at which this matter was discussed, of having a closed meeting. And it's not a majority decision of the committee if it is not permitted by the rules. The rules make the decision if in terms of whether it's closed or not. The committee then can, within the rules, decide on the closing of the meeting. I agree with that, but it has to be within the rules. And I don't see provision in the rules that allow for the meeting that's due to take place tomorrow to be a closed meeting.
Honourable members, before I take any of you, it is not my duty to interpret the rules. There's our legal experts here. But you see, once you do what Honourable Liz is doing, reading the rules in the manner in which he does, and not even looking at 1842, which I'm going to read to you, before Advocate Jenkins do what he's trained to do. 1842 says, a decision in terms of sub-rule 1 to exclude the public must be taken after due consideration by the committee or subcommittee concerned, provided that the chairperson, and I repeat, provided that the chairperson of the committee or subcommittee may at any time, A, before the start of the meeting, rule that the meeting must take place in a closed session. It's here in the rules, it gave him that power to do that. Because it was raised in the meeting, and the rules empowers him to decide that. So please, honourable members, let's not be expeditious when we read the rules. We must read the rules properly.
Madam Chair, are you saying you're changing your position? So it wasn't a resolution of the committee, it was
not... I don't have a position, I was not in the meeting. I was not in the meeting. I am bound by the decisions of the meetings in my absentia. I'm merely interpreting the rule that
The chairperson has the right, based on this rule book, to do that. And I understand Mr. Liz to be misinterpreting what Teboho is saying. Teboho is making it very clear that this matter was raised here, and the instruction was given on the spot in the meeting. And the DA did not dispute that fact at that time. That's why the secretariat went ahead to arrange for a closed meeting. Members of the ANC who are here confirms that I wanted us, on the basis of what you raised, to get a legal opinion. Now, you decided to read the rules. Now, I read Rule 2 of 184. Now, maybe I should do this. I must give Advocate Jenkins to interpret the rules. Because a decision is not going to be changed, it has been taken, which the chairperson is empowered. And I understood that it is about this, the presentation on the turnaround strategy, which we agreed in principle that it will be in a closed session. In my presence now, in meetings where I was. Honorable Nhleko, I'll come to you, Honorable Member.
No, thanks. What disturbs me is the misrepresentation. And this happens when all of us are here, and that worries me. And that's what needs to be corrected. I did not understand, for instance...
Madam Chair, on a point of order, who's misrepresenting and what is being misrepresented? It is a point of order.
Chair, I'm still making that
point. No, that's not a point of order. It's not sustained. A point of order is
I'm
different
still
from what...
That point.
It's just an interjection.
I'm still making that point. Honorable Liz says that there was a discussion between the chair and the staff member. And certainly that is not the issue that was raised and said here in this meeting, currently as we're sitting here. It was never put across as a discussion between the chair and a member of the staff supporting this committee. Now, And that point is important, and I think it's very material, because then, if we do not clarify it will seek to then say that even for us who then say, if the matter was declared openly here in this meeting, that there shall be facilitation for a session such as the one that is envisaged for tomorrow, and so on. And that makes it officially a record and a position of this committee, despite the rule book for now, okay? But the other point that I want to make, and of course I shouldn't be understood wrongly here, we can't exclusively rely on the PMG record. I mean, from experience, the written record by PMG is not as elaborate as what you would find in Hansard. In fact, the PMG record, the audio is much more better than the captured version, the written version, and so forth. So we can't then have and stand on one leg and say, yeah, the PMG record says.
On a lighter note, the PMG says I've attended 81 meetings out of 82, and they rate that as 95%.
Sure.
And okay. So I don't know how accurate.
Yeah. So
only one meeting I missed, and then they say it's 95%. It's not 99%, it's 95%. So you want me to take that here? No, really.
Okay. So if we want to verify the record, then we have answered. Whether it was said in the meeting or not said in the meeting, that there shall be a closed session, then it's the Hansard. So when I'm referring to misrepresentation, it's exactly this point, because it was never said that it was a discussion between two people. It was in the meeting context. Unless, of course, the staff member disputes what I'm saying, that indeed it was a discussion between herself and the chair. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Honorable Maina, Honorable Mukangu, in that order, please.
Chair, this case is even more curious than I first thought, because your version is that the chairperson has taken a decision to close the meeting, and that is the chairperson's
power. You're misconstruing my point. I never said so. Let me correct you on the spot. That's not what I said.
Well, let me finish, Chair.
I was reading what the rule is saying.
Okay. Well, it seems that there is a version that the committee chair decided that the meeting should be closed. That version is disputed by Tebogo, who says that in fact an application was made to close the meeting, which suggests that somebody other than the chairperson decided that the meeting.
I'm also deliberately misconstruing what you said.
And that.
No, honourable members, we're not going to do this. I'm not going to allow you to do this.
So
you're deliberately misconstruing what you said. That's not what you said.
I'm just quoting.
So no, that's not what you said.
That we
receive
a copy of the so-called
honourable members.
Response.
I said to you, I've said that I've come to a point where I must give Advocate Jenkins to interpret the law. Now that we are being played with semantics.
Chairperson, with respect, Tebogo did say that an application was made. Now, the question is, to whom was that application made, and can we have a copy of the application and the reply?
It's immaterial in terms of closing the meeting. You are discussing the closing, not the application.
Well, the application was made to close the meeting. It can hardly be immaterial to a decision of whether to close a meeting.
No.
That statement is
you are misinterpreting.
Ridiculous.
Advocate Jenkins, please. It's your opportunity now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, honourable members, chair, colleagues. Chair, I think, if I may, with respect, just to cool things down a bit, there have been no minutes, I've just checked with our committee secretaries, has been adopted concerning this issue, firstly. Secondly, what the rules are saying, and there's a reason why the rules are saying what it says, that obviously Parliament, by default, is an open institution. Committees must be open, public must have access. But we deal with all kinds of information. And if Parliament requests information, you will be breaking the law if you refuse to give that information. So to protect certain sensitive of information, we can close meetings. And the way it happens is the committee decides to close it. The so-called application, and there's been a lot of confusion around it, it is an application form, but it serves more to inform the political leadership of the institution. Before they read it in the media that again a meeting has been closed and there was some controversy about it and so on, the committee decides to close the meeting. The committee can of course be told by the political leadership, look, we don't think that meeting must be closed, and not because a lot of things have political echoes far beyond what one expected at the time. Now, Chair, what the rules then say is the committee decides to open or close a meeting. Obviously, you can only open it when it was closed. But the chairperson, and that's the part you read, the chairperson can decide to start with a closed meeting, and then the committee can say, well, what we're discussing here has got nothing to do with the test for whether a meeting should be closed or not. That test is set out in the Constitution, which is it reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society to close that meeting? Certain examples are given in the rules, but that's the way senior counsel has advised us to read the rule. So if we put in legislation, this is confidential information, information coming from the SIU or whatever, or the likes of that, SARS information, then obviously Parliament has already ruled on it by passing a law to say that is sensitive, that is confidential information, we don't have to unpack it further. But for all the rest of the stuff, obviously the issue of if it's prejudicial to a specific person, Parliament is not there to attack a person, we're there to oversight over the exercise of executive authority, we're not there to attack a person. So one must just read it in that sense that if there was a decision or a decision that is going to be taken by the chair to close the meeting, the committee can, during that closure, say, Chair, on a point of order, what we're discussing here does not, in our view, fall within that category. In other words, is it reasonable and justifiable to keep this meeting closed? And at that point, the committee can decide to open the meeting, and the media can come in, and PMG can come back in, etc., etc. But that's just the sort of the overview of it. The specifics I think it doesn't need to be said, but I'll say it. We will not know whether it should be closed or not closed until we get the information from SIA tomorrow. And during the course of that information, if it turns out that it's not what it says to be and that it needed to be closed, in fact, the Constitution will require the committee then to open the meeting and to have it per default position, open and accessible. So, ma'am, I don't know if I carry on, I'm going to repeat myself, but if there's questions, I'm glad to answer. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. You were very explicit. That's why I tried to explain to honourable members that there's no way that the quarterly report can be closed. The issue that was being discussed was the market-sensitive matters, specific ones. So it means when you come to that point where you discuss that part about the turnaround strategy, that's when people will not be there. But the normal quarterly report process has always been an open session we've had. In all the SAA reports, where it was never, there will not be a valid reason to close. And I'm saying, even when I was not there, there will not be a valid reason for the chair to, but he briefed me. He said, on the SAA's turnaround strategy, a decision has been taken to close that part. The media called me. I explained to them exactly what I'm saying to you right now, that in terms of the quarterly report presentation, that part, it's a democratic institution. It's open to public, to the media, to everybody. And the information, everybody is entitled to that. But even when the Reserve Bank comes here, there are certain market-sensitive issues that are never presented in an open session. It has never been an issue. It becomes an issue now when we're discussing SAA. So, honourable members, I think Advocate Jenkins has made it easier for all of us to understand. And he raised a fundamental issue. That which belongs to public will be there. That belongs to a closed session will be there. So I don't know beyond this point what you expect me to say. A decision was taken by this committee. Me as the acting chair, I'm not going to change that decision, especially when I was not even part of that meeting, but especially when the principle has been adopted. So I don't understand. What are we discussing? There's no way that the turnaround strategy is going to be discussed in an open meeting. It is not. Honourable, I'll at least give you the last opportunity. At least you say you have been gagged in a meeting.
Chairman, Madam Chair, I just want to put on record that this committee has, in my knowledge, not made a decision to close the meeting. So that's the first point. And so we'll differ on that. That decision was not made by this committee, and unless my memory is very, very bad, and we'll get hold of the Hansard and we will check the record. Secondly, then, to Frank, let's assume that the meeting is closed tomorrow and the quarterly report is presented, because that's the agenda for tomorrow, not the turnaround strategy. And I'll read you the Z list. Briefing by SAA on their latest quarterly report, dash, big letters, closed meeting. So if you read this, it means the meeting is closed for the quarterly report. So under those circumstances, I would suggest to you that it would not be constitutional for the meeting to have been closed in advance. And certainly, in my opinion, the committee never made such a decision. So if the meeting is closed and the public are not permitted to enter tomorrow morning, when is it up to the members of the committee immediately to lodge an objection, or do we need to first listen to the quarterly report to hear whether indeed it might somehow justify the meeting being closed?
Okay. Chair, I think for everybody's interest, I would like to suggest that we agree as a committee
not as ANCSGA, whoever, as a committee, that tomorrow we focus on the quarterly report open meeting, and the other part that we think we have, that we think is sensitive and we have taken a decision on, is set aside until the chairperson is here and everybody who's concerned go to the Hansard and verify that information and bring it back to the committee, and we review that a position if we have to, but after satisfying ourselves. That's my suggestion.
There's a proposal on the table.
I support that.
You've made my job very easy, honorable members. Tomorrow we'll not discuss the turnaround strategy. We'll discuss the quarterly report of National Treasury, and then the other matters after having been verified, because the DA says it doesn't recall any such discussion. So that matter will be clarified when the chairperson is back, and that portion of the report will be dealt with at that time. Honorable Liz, we need to round up now.
Madam Chair, I can't agree to that. The turnaround strategy is not a secret document. It's already been presented to the committee. There may be aspects of that turnaround strategy which may have some sensitivity. But even if they do, may I ask then, if
Honourable
that
member,
is the
I
case...
I have ruled.
Madam Chair?
Honourable Member, I have ruled.
Are you telling me I may not...
I'm entitled to make a ruling.
No, Madam Chair, you're not entitled to make a ruling that...
I am entitled the opposition. To make a ruling on how to proceed. I have the right to make a ruling on how to proceed. Here is Advocate Jenkins. He can explain to you those powers if there's some blurred. Any other matter except the one I've ruled on? Yes, Honourable Member.
Back to the point, could we please, as soon as possible today, have a copy of the application and the response to that application circulated to members of the committee?
Okay, Jenkins, can you respond on the procedure of how this is done, please?
Thank you, ma'am. I was not involved with the application I don't have records of it. The nature of, usually it's a sort of a letter informing or requesting that it be closed from the chairperson. It's drafted by the admin and sent to Mr. Cedric Frolic, who will then respond to it. I don't think there's no confidentiality attached to it for the committee itself as part of a committee procedure, but I would like just to reiterate, and I'm saying this with the greatest of respect, and that is more of a notification than an application. As I said, of course, the leadership of the institution expresses a view sometimes there to say, reconsider your position around this or refine it. And the reason is that there must be consistency. There's one test in the Constitution for closing a meeting, and that test should be applied consistently throughout the institution. So that is why we have that form and we have that communication coming from a central place within the institution. As far as I know, it is not something that members can't see. I mean, I cannot see a reason why not. I speak under correction. But if it is there, if there has been a response, certainly it's for the chairperson to decide to distribute that for members and to discuss it, or whether to have it as an agenda item. So let me just leave it at that, ma'am. I can see this is a very sensitive issue, and I'm sure it will be ventilated properly when the decision is taken then to close it, to have that turnaround strategy discussed in the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Members, this brings us... I'll deal with administrative issues outside the meeting. Can we now officially close the meeting? Honourable Members, you are not off the hook. Cluster 4, National Assembly. Tomorrow what time is the meeting? 10 o'clock. Announcements will be made tomorrow about how we proceed in the meeting. All the feedback that members need, they will have it tomorrow. Don't panic.
if you will all get reports about everything else that you have raised here today. Thank you very much for your attention.